right, we are back with episode 485 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I'm so happy they finally found a use for Montreal's Olympic Stadium.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm so happy to welcome back an old friend.
Yeah, and we are obviously in the midst of the very tail end of the kind of lull between the summer and fall seasons. Yes, I know by the time this goes out, the things are hot and heavy. And like I said, we knew that would happen.
Yep.
But for us
right now, we are standing on the beach as the water has receded far, far away. And we are just awaiting the tsunami that's going to tumble over us momentarily.
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty much the best way to put it. All right. So let's see. I mean, you know, we could go right into it. But at the same time, the weirdness is that we were all in the same place about 3 weeks ago, and we haven't really caught up too much since then. So, I mean, Gary, what have you been up to that's fun, hopefully, in the last few weeks, other than recovering from a late bout of crud, from what I understand?
I refuse to call it that. Anyway, well, two things really quick, and I don't necessarily want to get ahead of ourselves, but I did have a chance to watch that Z Nation series that started up, and it's not quite, Sharktopus or anything like that. It's a little bit better quality, so I'm not sure whether to call it an A minus or a B plus type of thing, but it's been enjoyable. To switch gears, my son has discovered Netflix.
And, oh boy.
Well, yeah, it's more good than bad. He went through all of Eureka.
Wow.
He mainlined it over the course of about two weeks.
Wow.
And he really enjoyed it. And at some point I had mentioned Sliders to him, and it is on Netflix, and he's starting to watch it. And, you know, I have to say, it's one of those things when, you know, I'd watched this as, you know, I guess I was in my late teens when I watched it, and early 20s, and I've remembered it much more fondly than it's coming across now.
Yeah.
More importantly, I know what poor endings most of the characters came to. So as I watch it, I go, oh, poor Wade. My son's like, what? I said, he's like, well, do any of them ever get home? I said, well, you know, Cleveland makes it home, but, you know, all the rest, you know. And he's like, oh, what about, what's it? Not, who's the Jerry character? Quinn. He's like, what about Quinn? I said, it doesn't even go well for his brother either. He goes, what brother?
Whoops. Yes. Spoilers.
He's like, stop that. You know, I feel bad. I feel bad. And I've now had to stop discussing it with him because he says I keep spoiling everything. So, I've backed up a little bit. I'm looking forward. He said Voyagers is on his plan to watch next. So I'm hopeful because that show I've watched since my youth. And I think it holds up a lot better than Sliders ever did. Of course, then I mentioned Boom Boom, and he wanted to know what that was, too, and I just said, no, I better stop.
Yeah, Sliders, I mean, especially knowing that they moved over to sci-fi at some point, and it got even more...
I haven't even talked about all the actual studio drama that occurred as actors were coming in and leaving, showrunners were literally getting booted out and asked back, and then that whole messy last season when they were basically, you know, copying every movie that was out over this previous summer, and it gets really rough. I'm hoping he dissuades, you know, loses interest by, say, I think it was season 3 when they left it to go over to sci-fi, so we can hope. But, you know, at the same time, you know, as we, you know, try to introduce our kids to stuff, especially stuff that we're interested in or we were interested in, some, you know, you have to throw it up against the wall, and you're happy when some of it sticks. And so I can't complain. You know, he's watching science fiction TV. You know, what else better is there to watch? You know, I suppose he could watch sports, but, you know, I'll take alternate dimensions over a football game any day. So.
I suppose that's true. Let's see. Any good reading material, or have you been still?
I am in the morass pit somewhere between King's Landing and the and was it Lothan or something like that? Anyway, I'm what's the fourth book? Is it Storm of Swords?
A Feast of Crows or Feast for Crows? Or
yeah,
something?
Feast for Crows. That's the one I'm in right now, and I'm about 200 pages shy of the end, and I feel comfortable at this point that I know I have probably read past where the next season will go on HBO. So I do feel I've reached a comfort zone, but I am gonna push through, and I think I'll finish the whole series before I jump into my ever stacking pile of books that I'm waiting to read.
Yes, well, there is the whole issue of the fifth book overlapped the fourth book, but anyway.
No! Damn you, Martin!
Yeah, today he apparently turned 66, and I was like, oh, happy birthday. Sit down and write.
Yes. You're turning into one of them. Okay.
Turning into?
I can see it now. Who do I kill today?
Yeah, exactly. It's a good day. Maybe I'll kill two characters. We'll see how that all goes, I guess. But yeah, good. Wow, I wasn't even sure that you had gotten past the third book, let alone this far into the fourth book. So.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, good progress. How about you, Edmund? What have you been up to the last few weeks?
I already mentioned last episode about I had my rant about the bridge and how good it's been, and of course, in recent years we've had this whole spate of American shows based on these fabulous Danish crime dramas, and because a friend recently decided to binge watch the American version of The Killing, and it was rather interesting, even though I haven't seen the American version, but had heard enough about it that he seemed to have a reaction similar to many, where he was actually rather enjoying it, and then it got to the end of the third season, and he's decided he doesn't even want to start watching the fourth season or that little short fourth season they used to supposedly finish things up, but as a result of talking to him about that, I have finally, one reason why I hadn't watched the American version was because unlike with The Bridge, where I watched the American but hadn't watched the original Danish version, I really wanted to watch the original Killing, and so I've just started the first few episodes of that, and it really is just as fabulous as I've heard. And there was one thing in the very opening episode where and this, yes, I know I give the spoiler disclaimer at the beginning of each episode, but I will just mention something about that opening episode, which isn't really a spoiler, especially since it is called The Killing. But we kind of get used on this side of the Atlantic to that convention of the body always being found towards the beginning of the episode, and the opening episode of The Killing, they go completely against that. You basically are, you see that she's in peril. But then it pulls back and you get introduced to all of the main characters, the police officers, her parents, and there are various politicians in the town. Cause there's a mayoral election going on that gets this gets caught up in, and the result is that when they actually get to the discovery of the body at the end of the episode, it makes the emotional impact just absolutely devastating, because you've actually gotten to know all of these characters and seeing the emotions play out across their faces. You know, that just in the course of that opening episode, they've already got you dragged in and empathetic, basically, with the emotional state that they're all getting dragged into. It actually reminded me that when I, speaking of another adaptation, when I was watching Broadchurch last year, I thought, my God, this is the rawest, most emotional depiction of a victim's family I've ever seen. But now that I've seen The Killing, I'm realizing, no, actually, I think they were cribbing a little bit, because the Killing's first couple of episodes are just as, if not more emotionally devastating than Broadchurch was. So I'm looking.
Wow!
Yes. Well, it's one of these cases of, you know, I'm looking forward to watching the rest of it, even though I can tell already it's going to be quite a emotional roller coaster. On book fronts, I actually have there's a couple of comic series that I've picked up actually over the last few months. I just haven't had a chance to mention them, but one thing when I'm picking up these various books, I do really enjoy reading the letter sections as much for the some of the comments about similar properties, and this actually started with Ed Brubaker's series Velvet, about this female spy who's been sort of been put on the shelf for a number of years, actually working as the assistant to the head of the agency, and most of the younger agents didn't even realize she was this top agent in the past. And and of course there various things happen to activate her basically she gets accused of a murder and has to go on the run. But in the letter section there, they Ed Brubaker, the writer, was actually asking people to talk about what are their favorite spy novels or spy properties, and that led me to some of Greg Rucka's work. One is this series from a few years ago called Queen and Country. Which, to me, feels like basically it's like the comic book version of The Sandbaggers, the British spy series from the mid-70s, which was basically like sort of James Bond combined with George Smiley, because for budget reasons, I mean, the Sandbaggers are like the covert ops people who get sent in, when it absolutely cannot have anything to do with the government. But the series itself, was basically set in the offices, these secret back offices, around Whitehall, where all of the paper was being pushed and the bureaucracy was going on. And with Queen and Country, it's kind of like the Sandbaggers, but if they actually had the budget to show the operations that they're going on, because you've got all the politics and the backstabbing, plus you have the agents out there pulling off these amazing missions. And the other series that's actually current is called Lazarus. And when I started reading this, it was when we were still watching the third season of Continuum, and the setup in Lazarus is, to my mind, very similar to the that alternate future that our mystery man came from in that latest season, that where it's a near future where governments have completely broken down, and basically all of the earth is being controlled by these corporate conglomerates who hold sway over the various geographic regions, and the Lazarus of the title is that they all have their own individual security forces, each of which is led by, depending on the family or corporation specialty, some sort of modified super soldier, which is the Lazarus. And yes, they're named Lazarus because it's really hard to kill them, because they can usually be regenerated in some shape or form. But that's been some rather intriguing reading, also has a very interesting letter section where both in terms of the comments on people talking about the sort of social and economic and political implications of the work, and Greg Rucka also pointing out scientific advances that are happening today that are actually very close to what he's showing in the comic book, as well as some of the economic and political theories that he's been reading up on to sort of inform this dystopian corporate future he's created.
Yeah, I don't know. When it comes to letter pages, I know that was earlier in the discussion, but Saga still is at the top of my list.
Well, yes, absolutely. But yeah.
That and maybe a second place goes to Kirkman and his commentary in the letters page for the Walking Dead comic.
Okay, yes.
Because that's equally off the wall.
Yeah, and of course, Saga's been back for in doing its current run, but of course we have waxed poetic about that quite a bit before. So.
Oh yes, many, many times. Unfortunately, I am way behind in my comic book reading, so I'm not actually up on Saga. I'm not up on much of anything. I think that I'm still back in what came out in May.
Okay.
So, I'm still way behind. It's just I started to kind of get caught up in other things, obviously. But the along those lines, I mean, I've been reading quite a few books of late. One of the series that I've been reading, and I'm fairly far into the third out of six volumes, would be the Codex Alera series by Jim Butcher, who most of us know as the author of the Dresden Files series.
How does it compare reading-wise? Is it written very similarly? I mean, I know it's the same author, but that doesn't always mean...
Yeah, it actually isn't. The Codex Alera is high fantasy, to a certain extent. The story as it goes, and Bronstone tells this much better than I do, but apparently the series started, at least conceptually, as a dare from a friend who said, Jim, I want you to write a story that mixes the Roman Empire and Pokemon. All right? Which, when you think about that, you cringe. However, what he came up with actually works really well. It's very action driven, but there's a lot of strong characterization. So it's just it's not as irreverently jokey in any way, shape, or form. It's a lot more serious, but that's because of the material. And to be fair, you kind of see where certain ongoing mysteries and storylines are going, but it's still a pretty solid read. It's just the books are very long. They're like 600 to 700 pages long. So it takes a little time to get through. But once you start going, it's like the Dresden Files. You just keep going and reading and reading until you suddenly realize 2.5 hours has gone by. So it was really good for waiting in the airport, coming and going to Dragon Con. But yeah, I've been reading those. I read the first two books in the Post-Vanguard series.
Ooh.
For Star Trek called Seekers. Very, very tightly interwoven two books. The one is obviously directly right after the other, but the storyline practically just continues right from one book into the other without really taking a break. So that has been, those have been good. I'm not feeling quite the same level of excitement that I did with Vanguard at this point, but the scope of the story is a little tighter. So unless and until it kind of widens out to the same extent that perhaps Vanguard did, it might take a little bit of time for me to get that feeling of that I had with Vanguard, but it's definitely a good follow-up. I mean, it's not terrible by any means.
Oh, that's good. That was a great series. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really happy that they decided to kind of continue on from there. Let's see as well. I am currently in about a quarter of the way through. I'm reading the first book of the quote-unquote new canon for Star Wars. I can't quite figure it out if it's supposed to be a novelization of the beginning of the Rebels series or a prequel to the Rebels series. I think it's kind of a mixture of both in a certain sense.
I thought they had marketed it as like you said, as a prequel. But
yeah, but it's kind of weird because I'm sitting back and thinking, how does this work as a prequel because they're introducing the characters? So, like I said, it's kind of, unless I'm mistaking how Rebels is supposed to start, but that's possible as well. My main concern is that they've marketed the fact that they're kind of starting, kind of resetting what is and is not canon to the extent that they're saying, hey, everything that comes out after this point is going to be shepherded in such a way that it ties into the story. So it's going to all be aligned. I feel like the writer was pushed to adapt his style to a more general audience-friendly tone because it's lacking a certain depth to it that, again, made me wonder if they were possibly adapting the Rebels scripts and that was part of the problem. But it's okay. It's not terrible, but it's not grabbing me. And I think in a way it's because it's just too simplistic. It's not, you know, young adult chapter book Star Wars, but it's also not Matthew Stover Star Wars by any stretch of the imagination. So we'll see. I mean, maybe it'll get darker as it goes because, of course, this is supposed to be the kind of dawn of the Rebel forces and such, but we'll see. It definitely feels to me like they're trying to do mass appeal versus something more substantial. But that's on the reading front. Let's see. As far as watching other things, I haven't really had a lot of time to watch other things as I've been trying to just stay up to date on everything here, which does not bode well for the fall. I'm going to have to change my ways a little bit. But I did finish out the current available material for Attack on Titan, which is, you know, uber popular anime out there right now. Gotten a few other people into it too, which is always fun. Beyond that, I've also just been kind of playing games a bit. I finished, before Dragon Con, I had finished Mass Effect 3, and then I tried playing a game called Remember Me that came out about a year ago. And when I first saw it at PAX East a couple of years ago, I was a little, I was interested in it. It was a fun game. The final product just didn't quite grab me. So from there, I moved to a classic, Jak and Daxter, the first game, and just yesterday finished playing that game, 100% completion. So it was a nice palate cleanser from some of the maybe heavier stuff. But I've just been kind of taking it easy on that level. Work has been a little bit hectic lately and will be for the next few weeks going into New York Comic Con, which, that's worthy of mentioning. New York Comic Con is in, I guess, 3 weeks. So that should be interesting. I have a few more people going than in the past that I know, so it'll be a nice kind of follow-up to Dragon Con this time in that regard.
Will you be cosplaying, John?
I will. Mostly the stuff that I did down in Dragon Con, though perhaps not everything. But, that was always the plan, was to kind of have a variety so that I could kind of rotate through them for a year or so and before tackling anything new. But, at least a couple days I will definitely be. I guess they keep moving the start time on Thursday up. And before it used to be like, if you were not press or professional, or even when you were press, I guess you had to be a pro or an exhibitor or whatever to get in before like 5 o'clock on Thursday. Then last year they moved it up to like 2 or 3 o'clock, and they started selling Thursday passes to the public. Now they're opening it at 1 o'clock to the public. I'm waiting to see if the following year they just stop playing coy and just
start on Thursday.
Start on Thursday morning. Of course, the thing is that because everybody expects it to be later in the day, they are all arriving on Thursday. So it's like you're juggling hotel, room availability. So it's like, okay, do you take your stuff to the Javits and then go, back to your hotel later or what? But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. Thankfully, the stuff that is at least announced so far, the stuff that I want to see, the panels and such, are later in the evening. So I have a little bit of a grace period there, as I've had in the past. But we'll see. I don't know if that's going to be the last time that can happen. But it's like people arriving on Friday morning for Dragon Con. Nope, you're gonna miss stuff. So you got to come in the day before, which is going to probably be very inconvenient for some of the professionals and other people. But they're kind of trying to become the new San Diego Comic-Con for the East Coast, so there we are. I will say this, though. When I look at the panels and the other stuff going on for New York Comic-Con, it's clear to me that there are a lot of people that are responding to some of the controversies in geek community of late, particularly, issues surrounding women and treatment thereof. And just diversity, because there is a ton of content in terms of panels and whatnot just devoted to the subject. That's a little bit interesting, especially when you have people in gaming and comic book industry and everything else that seem to be very dismissive of that. So I don't know if this is New York Comic Con maybe having also been criticized in the past for some of their choices. Maybe stepping up to the plate a little bit and not just doing something passively, but devoting a good chunk of their programming to, if not addressing the issue, at least discussing it. And I'll be very interested to see how those panels are received and if there's any type of, negativity and conflict that takes place. But hey, they're kind of taking it on, which is more than I can say for some of the other conventions and things out there. PAX East comes to mind, where they had a diversity room that was literally kind of off in the corner somewhere. Which was kind of like, hey, let's corral all of the non-normative people into a room where no one has to look at them. It's not quite that bad, but at the same time, that was the impression it gave some people because certainly they didn't have the kind of depth of exposure that they're doing at New York this time. So we'll see. Don't really have a whole lot else. Like I said, next weekend it's going to be a bit busy, so we might have to look at some alternatives, but there we are. Anything else that you guys can think of worthy of discussion? Usually we would be hearing some kind of complaints from our Australian contingent, but he is once again still on his American tour.
Yes, his grand American tour, yes.
Yes, exactly. So we'll see how that goes. Well, with no further ado, I suppose we could get back into our normal content, and we'll see how much of it we get through here. It may be another two-episode week for us. But I believe the third major topic that we wanted to cover was the return of Haven. So here's the promo.
My name is Mara.
Where the hell is she?
I don't think we want to find out.
What do you want with us?
She created the troubles. She's got to know how to end them.
This will be unpleasant.
Haven premieres this Thursday at 8, only on Sci-Fi.
And Gary, why don't you go ahead and do the recap for this? If Gary is still there. Oh, he's going to be right back. Great timing. Okay, I'll go ahead and do that then. Haven, Season 5, Episode 1, See No Evil. Season 5 begins with Nathan and Duke coping with the loss of Audrey, who seems to be gone for good after having transformed into the wickedly evil Mara. Now, Edmund, I think you don't actually watch the show, right?
I do not, and I don't think I have the power to transform into Gary just for this segment.
No, but if I'm correct, that was the sound of him turning his mic back on. So, Gary.
Yes,
Nathan,
sir.
Haven, 5th season premiere.
Oh, my gosh.
What would you give it?
I would give it an 8.5.
Okay. And hold on for a second, please. I gave it a 6.
Ooh.
Yes. Talk about having a very different set of opinions.
I know Audrey's not there right now, technically, but still, that's kind of harsh.
Well, Gary, 8.5. Why an 8.5?
Well, I like where they went with it. I enjoy that we, number one, didn't see tons of new troubles necessarily appearing, like by the gross load, which is sort of the hint or worry that I have as, you know, as they got, what's her name now? Not Laura.
Mara.
Mara. As Mara had the power to distribute them, but now we find out that without the guy, she can't do that anymore. Or at least he's got the little black balls of goop or whatever that enable them to do it. So it again introduces another sort of mystery that she's kind of beholden to him, or at least wherever they're getting this stuff to give the troubles, it's not something that's built into them that they're able to do. It's some external source. So I enjoyed that revelation. I enjoyed the fact that the girl who first was sealing the door is going ahead of Mara and sealing up all these other portals that we didn't know about. I thought that was nice. That was a nice little twist to things. I enjoy how people don't think that Audrey's gone, but yet Mara continues to insist that she is, and I don't see any implication that Audrey is going to come back. So I like that sort of at least finality that they've presented to us, whether or not it turns out to be true. I'm enjoying the one trouble that they introduced over the two troubles, because you had the girl in the gazebo in the beginning with the one trouble that seemed rather innocuous. Somehow she turns her drawings into life somehow, and the second trouble I felt it all flowed within the storyline. So I have to say I thought it was a nice strong opening. I don't think it dwelt so far on the past that it was that you couldn't get into it at this point. And thirdly, I enjoy that they blew up the lighthouse again, and this time it's going to stay down.
I thought it was funny, at least, that they had that one comment about that. How many times have we rebuilt that thing? it's almost become the Jeep from Eureka.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
here's my issue a little bit with this, is that first of all, there was nothing it really indicating other than the kind of variable level of serialization that we've seen from season to season in the past to suggest that this was not a single episode premiere. As it turns out, it's actually part one. Part two is next week. But to me, it just felt like it didn't go anywhere. It was introducing a few things, but I was kind of struggling to get the feel of Haven as it was recognizable to my, you know, to my recollection at the very least. I mean, I know that things changed dramatically last season because they're now really peeling back the layers of mystery ever since that incident at the barn. But now we've got, I guess I was hoping that they would come out of it with a little bit stronger, in a more firm position of where things stand, and that they would come out with a very strong, just presentation of the new status quo. And it's obvious that they intend to take a bit longer to parse out some of the implications of what happened. And
well, I think
it's, it felt like they didn't quite do very much in this episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see your point. For example, if Mara had some sort of grand scheme other than opening those gates, if she had some sort of, you know, long range plan, but even William and Mara, other than we're going to put down troubles on more people and have fun, ha ha ha, it was never a very deep plot. It wasn't like they wanted to kill everyone. It wasn't like they had, there's some purpose to, you know, once we distribute all the troubles, then this will happen or something like that. We're still not getting that sort of grand scheme that the old Who's Audrey Parker subplot used to give us for several seasons. So I can see that. But yeah, like I said, I thought I don't think there's an overarching story presented in this episode. I agree. And I guess that's what you're saying is where it falls short for you.
I feel like there's not even a really firm sense of what the status quo is. It feels like it's just like everything's still in chaos from the second half of last season, which, okay, but I kind of feel like the characters need to have their foot on the ground a little bit more. And that, and yeah, I understand that we're not doing this whole Audrey Parker mystery quite so much as we used to, because obviously that is more or less been resolved. There's still one sticking point out there, which they have yet to really address, which is, all right, if this is the whole mechanism for everything, then how did she get these memories of this other Audrey Parker in the first place? How does that work? They've never explained that. They just kind of said, well, that's what happened, and okay. But that's part of the problem, too, is that we've got Mara now, who is an actual one of the two people that was involved at some point in the past of the
500
town.
Years ago.
Yeah. Of starting
before the town, yeah.
Yeah, and yet this character, at least to this point, is not, it's not being used as a means of exploring that mythology yet. And I kind of was irritated when they had William around and that they would hint that he knew what was going on and it never really went anywhere with it. It's, they've got this big blatant trigger to get into that material and they're just not going there.
Yeah, well, no, I agree with you. Once Mara got her, you know, realized who she was, you would think that she would be on an equal level with William, with her knowledge, you know, knowledge of the troubles and the history and everything like that. And it still feels like she's somewhat lost without William.
Yeah, and maybe that's what it is that it's all these things that, again, I didn't realize that this was supposed to be at least kind of hinted to be an ongoing, you know, stronger serialization than what we saw in the previous seasons. And so a lot of the things I believe are going to be kind of addressed next episode. Certainly a lot of the stuff that's going on with Duke and his status,
well,
and
I love
why
that
people's
reflection.
Faces are being sewed up and all of that. But
yeah, well, I love the Duke revelation. I thought that was really cool that, you know, that every trouble that he or his family have absorbed is now becoming loose and going back to the original family line that cured it. That I thought that was really a sort of a cool way to take his character, because, you know, we had assumed that once they sort of absorbed that trouble, it was gone. Instead, he's just been a bank for it the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. It is. I mean, that does. open up a few interesting doors. I mean, and again, this may all eventually be leading to some grand revelation of as to how this all started, and that being then the trigger for how it's all going to be resolved. And if, as I suspect, this is the final season for the show, having two kind of having a fifth season that's as long as two actual seasons that's going to be split up like it's two seasons.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
you can kind of see that like half the season is going to be maybe getting into some of the answers to these questions, and then the final 13 episodes would be the resolution to everything. But yeah, until they really start, I feel like they just kind of threw a bunch of stuff at us in this premiere, and it really didn't gel for me. I needed a little bit more concrete.
I agree that there wasn't a lot of structure to this episode. I can definitely, or to the story that it was telling. I agree with you. And I think you hit on it. It's not an open, it's the continuing of the last episode from last season.
Yeah. That and the lack or the sudden disappearance of Jennifer, who was so important last season and hinted to be extremely important to the overall series, is just gone.
Well, they said she was going around sealing those holes, so
well, that's what
the actor wasn't available.
Yeah, I that's what characters were thinking was going on, but my understanding is, and it was kind of out there, so again, oh, sorry, people. By the way, we forgot to do a spoiler thing, but Edmund kind of alluded to it earlier. My understanding is that the actress didn't come back. She chose not to come back. So, yeah, that... the fact that it was just kind of left out there was a little bit, again, I don't know, maybe they'll address it in the future, but it still felt like they were leaving way too many things open-ended by the end of this episode. It was just kind of keeping on. And I would have maybe appreciated another small, short flashback to back in the day. Maybe they couldn't get Colin back to do that, but at any rate, so it just was not the strong start that I was perhaps hoping for.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would have enjoyed a sort of more of a plan or some sort of Mara, you know, doing something as opposed to basically wandering aimlessly portal to portal. Although Dwight getting shot never does get old. So.
Maybe if they wanted to go with that, it wouldn't be so bad if they just focused on that and dug into it a little bit more. But to have that going on while there's this completely unexplained thing of people's faces sewing up by themselves, you've got Duke dealing with not knowing what's going on with himself, it's just all over the map. At least it was for me. And I was like, I kept feeling like, okay, when is this going to come together? And then it was like the credits rolling. I was like, what? We'll see. It may just be a soft start to the season, and it'll pick back up where I'm used to it being as we go along here. But yeah, not my favorite episode or season premiere.
I guess I was just glad to see everybody back. So.
Well, and we've got quite a lot of Haven to come, so there's that. Let's see. We can then, I guess, move on to our quick hits for the week, which there's not even a long list of those. So, Edmund.
Sir, yes?
If you can come back to the fold.
Absolutely.
And let's see, the first one that we have here, if you could go ahead and take that.
Sure. This is a couple of episodes of The Lottery. We've got Season 1, Episode 7, St. Michael. Allison and James share with Vanessa their theory about the source of the fertility crisis. Meanwhile, Vanessa discovers Darius is working with some co-conspirators to take over the lottery. Kyle is asked to compromise his relationship with Allison, and Gabrielle takes the press behind the scenes of the lottery as contestants face psychological evaluations.
And what would you give this one?
I think I would give this one a 7.5.
Yeah, I would continue to give this an 8. I really liked how just devious that the writers are getting here, and how disturbing some of these directions are going. This whole lottery process is just plain creepy.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And I like how it's being used, abused, however you want to use it, whatever word you want to apply. It's just working for me, and that continued into the next episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to mention for my cryptic opening was referring to this because I spent so much time in Montreal over the years that it is a wonderful use of the stadium because even though it was built for the 76 Olympics, it does have this very futuristic look to it. But it does tend to take me out of the show because it's like, no, I know you're in Montreal, you're not in Washington or anywhere in the U.S. but that's just me. Moving on to season 1, episode 8, Truth Be Told. Allison follows up on the evidence James uncovered, but her investigation hits a dead end. Vanessa uncovers Darius' plan to take control of the lottery. Meanwhile, Kyle discovers the May 2's real agenda, and Perry tries to help Angela as she struggles in the final round of the lottery competition. And for this one, I don't know if I'm going to be joining you on this episode, but yes, I think I would give this one an 8.
It's funny, we kind of switched here.
Okay.
I went down a little bit to a 7.5.
Okay.
It continued to do the same things that the previous episode did, but I think that was part of the problem. It continued to do the things that the previous episode did. If you had watched these two back to back, I think it would have felt like it just kept going and going and going.
Okay. Yeah. I think I may, in fact, have watched them back to back. For me, I think it was more a question of it was ramping up and continuing, and
feeling this whole back and forth between the first lady and that one particular
contestant. Yeah,
I forget her name. The contestant. Yeah, yes. In the lottery, just it was hitting the same notes over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it is ramping up, but and the episode did end well, which is why it wasn't a complete average episode, but yeah. It kind of took away a little bit of the good feeling I had coming out of the few episodes before this. Out of the four that have covered the actual lottery process, I feel like it was the weakest. Not in a huge way, but just it kind of lost a little bit there, for me anyway. It's still this season of the lottery is still remarkably strong. I mean, it's certainly better than Witches of East End or whatever that other show is.
Yes, yeah, it's funny because since I always have my DVR set to start about 5 minutes early, I do keep catching the culminating scene of Witches of East End, and even just seeing that, I can kind of see the difference in quality between these two shows.
That's about as much of it as I see, and that's exactly the feeling I get. Is the what why? Just why? But there we are. It's you know, we've had a lot of shows that are maybe not knocking out of the park this summer, but are in a very comfortable, you know, slightly above average score, and this is one of them.
Mm-hmm. And forgive me if I mentioned this before, but one thing that I am finding intriguing is this whole thing with it being on Lifetime and having the, you know, Lifetime being that network aimed more, you know, very deliberately aimed more towards women. I'm finding it intriguing watching a series where they are very, very deliberately keeping the focus on the female characters, and it's the male characters who are more in the background. It is an interesting little reversal on the way most shows do it that just kind of points out the conventions, and it's rather nice to see that turned on its head.
I'm not entirely unsure that might be one of the reasons that I'm enjoying it, just that it's presenting a different perspective.
Yeah.
And even Children of Men, which is, you know, at least somewhat similar in topic, was from a male perspective.
Oh yeah, it's Clive in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. This is really about what would a fertility crisis mean for women.
Mm-hmm.
But in a realistic context where it's not like men are being ignored, it's just that it is being treated more on it's a fairly equal and logical perspective and presentation, but there is this plethora of female characters at the forefront that, yeah, it's just showing that you don't have to appeal to men in that sense of putting them in the prominent roles in order for it to still be a good story that everyone can enjoy.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's surprisingly strong. It's good science fiction, that's for sure. Let's see. It's got kind of those shades of Atwood a little bit.
Yes.
In there.
Definitely.
Next one is Intruders. Oh boy. Season 1, episode 4. Ave Verum Corpus. Gary learns something very strange about Amy, which suggests a larger, more terrifying conspiracy. Meanwhile, Madison arrives in Seattle and threatens an old acquaintance. Rose puts pressure on Richard, and Jack and Gary find a reliable source. What would you give this one?
I will give this one a 6.5.
Okay, and I'll give it a 6. Yeah, they kind of lost some of the good feeling I had after the previous episode and went back to the really just what were they thinking side of things. This show is just not coming together.
No.
The more they peel back the conspiracy, the more ludicrous it seems.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's where, I can't remember if I gave it a 6 last, but yeah, but I'm giving it basically a half point for revealing a little bit more about the backstory, even though it's not really holding together. But it's definitely still getting downgraded on some major absurdities, not the least of which is a former LA cop who lets, that's right. No, I was going to say, yes, I can't remember the character names. I'll just call him James Frame, but no, it is Richard Shepherd. Walk into that restaurant and gun down the guy they're there to see without getting any tingles of something's not going right here. But...
or people even, for that matter, really doing much about it.
Yeah, yeah.
They just kind of, huh?
Yeah.
And half of them don't even react.
Exactly.
I mean, who was directing these extras? That's all I can say.
Yeah, it was really very strange.
It's a show that I can see falling off my radar very quickly with the new season coming up. Unfortunately,
yeah.
It's just not, there's a great cast, but they're not being given anything really good to do. The story isn't that great. And my understanding is that this is not unlike, The Leftovers, a show that is an adaptation of a novel. And I don't know, is it that the adaptation of the novel is not very good, or is the source material just not as strong as people thought it was?
Yeah.
One way or the other, the show just, it looks great on paper and the tone is really nice, but as soon as you start trying to do storytelling, it starts to fall apart.
Yeah, and I actually had it also did pale in comparison this week. After I know I finally caught up with David Lynch's Mulholland Drive this week, and which is, you know, it's has these sort of elements of Blue Velvet to it, but just upping the surreal and the weird to extreme levels. And I kind of felt, you know, after watching that, I was thinking, it's like, yeah, this is what Intruders is trying to do and just failing miserably at. Although it was also very strange to see Justin Theroux playing an arty independent film director 14 years ago, speaking of The Leftovers. So.
I don't know. I had high hopes for this show just based on the promos, and it looks like it's just not living up to it.
No.
How are we on time, by the way?
We are at 55 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, I think we're just going to blow through then to the end.
Absolutely.
And we'll just have two shows this time around.
Yep.
Sorry for those who were hoping for Friday night entertainment.
Yes. Unfortunately, folks, what we need is we would have needed the doctor to show up and let us go see some of those shows from next week so we could talk about them this week.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, we're just going to move on then to The Musketeers. Season 1, Episode 8, The Challenge. The Red Guards, who are tired of the Musketeers' treatment of LaBarge, provoke a confrontation between the two regiments. King, who is... wow, this is the worst...
Yes.
Thing I've seen in a long time. All right, that's enough. I'm not going to go through the rest of the recap because it's written terribly. We have this competition between the Red Guards and the Musketeers, and this brings D'Artagnan's particular issues to the forefront because, well, he's out of money,
mm-hmm.
and he can't even pay his rent. Oh, and yeah, that woman that he was with, yeah, she's married. Her husband found out.
Yeah.
Oops. So that all said, as a recap, because I wasn't going to read the one that was provided, what would you give this one?
I would give this a 7.
Okay. I'm trying to... You know, I think I'm going to have to go with 6.5.
Mm-hmm. I toyed with that, I will admit, but...
There's two things here. First of all, on the basis of plot alone, this one should have been fine, or would have been fine. Unfortunately, it still did rely on an extremely tired plot device. And quite frankly, this episode felt like it would never end. I seriously thought that it was coming to a conclusion about halfway through the actual runtime.
Yeah.
It just was incredibly slow paced. So easily one of the least effective episodes in my mind, particularly because the last few have been really actually quite good.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a real step backward for me.
Yeah. And also, this was a case of casting Vinnie Jones as LaBarge. I mean, he works in certain roles, but this one it just didn't really work for me. I mean, it's, you know, Vinnie Jones is good at playing Vinnie Jones and being a, you know, being a thug, which is what he was called on to do. But actually, being convincing as a thug from that time period just didn't really happen.
Yeah, it just did not work for me. So unfortunately, this was a bit of a step backward, but there's still a couple episodes left of the season. Let's see how well they salvage it. And Edmund, if you could take the next one.
Certainly. This is the latest Masters of Sex, Season 2, Episode 10, Below the Belt. Johnson tries to find a cure for Masters' sexual difficulties. Masters learns of a rival study and tries to brand his work. Flo informs Langham that he must have sex with her in order to keep his job. Barbara and Lester connect over their shared sexual dysfunctions. Libby asks Johnson to give her an alibi while she canvasses a tenement for rent strike with Core. I would give this one a 7.5. I'm still having, as well acted as it is, this decision to make the sexual dysfunction storyline a personal one and have it be as much about Bill Masters trying to overcome his impotence, which I've since last week's episode, I did actually dig into the Thomas Mayer biography a little bit more. And as far as I can tell, that yes, this is absolutely fabricated from whole cloth. While Bill Masters and his wife did have to undergo fertility treatments to conceive their child. He apparently has never had any of the issues that they're bringing up, making him struggle with in the series. And I think it's a case of them putting too much of the emphasis on the two main characters. And it's particularly annoying when they've got Barbara and Lester established as secondary characters who are dealing with these dysfunctions. They're part of the reason why they're starting to delve into them, are you know, both available as characters and as wonderful actors to introduce this whole storyline. Kind of in contrast to what we were talking about with Manhattan, where they've been developing the secondary characters and giving us this very rich tapestry of the interactions going on. I feel it's a case of with Masters of Sex, of where they're starting to focus just way too much on Masters and Johnson, and they need to expand the canvas a bit, because certainly some of the stuff that was going on. I mean, I really liked the stuff with Adam Arkin, who also directed the episode, being brought in as this PR guy to start trying to market the study more and get them out before the public, before this rival researcher can steal their thunder. And as I said, Barbara and Lester, and then the stuff going on with Libby, Master's wife, and her involvement with Core, it's still feeling a little clumsy, not as clumsy as the stuff that was going on with the nanny earlier in the season, but it still feels a little tacked on. So it's a case of, you know, no, it doesn't bring it down to a horrible score, but just compared to what I know the show is capable of, I'm still finding it a little disappointing at the moment.
Now, Gary, from what I understand, you actually tuned in for this episode, or am I mistaken?
Yes, no, you're absolutely, yeah, I managed to catch this episode. I don't follow the series, so there were a lot of things that I didn't quite understand or get, I guess understand is probably the simplest way to put it. I thought it was, I guess it was interesting, and this is not, I can definitely not recommend jumping in this episode for this series. The characterizations I thought were well done. Some of the interactions between Masters and Johnson, without getting too risque, I thought were I thought were well done for the subjects that they had to cross. I didn't understand the secondary characters, so I guess maybe those are the ones that I guess have been built up over time, but I didn't have a sense of them from this episode, their motivations or why they were doing what they were doing. I enjoyed the pressure story where they were running, you know, starting to run out of money. I thought that was well handled with the I guess I'll call her the, you know, office manager.
Yes.
Trying to explain to Masters, you know, how it really is, and so I thought that was very interesting. I enjoyed his frustration over belittling, I guess, in the the scientific journal. So I thought there were a lot of interesting points. You know, the sexual situations were interesting, although I didn't feel that I was introduced to his dysfunction in this episode to fully understand why they were doing what they were doing with each other. I understood the whole clinical aspect of it, but not the personal aspect.
Yeah, that's something that you need to have been watching since the beginning of the season. This has been their ongoing affair. Under the guise initially that they were just continuing their research.
Oh, okay, but no, I like the time period setting was, you know, was reasonably accurate. I didn't quite understand why she was there. I did enjoy the scenes with Libby canvassing about the rent strike and, you know, pushing forward for, you know, the social agenda that was so prominent in the 60s. That was nice to see that covered in the episode, and it was good. It wasn't enough to draw me back to really go back and watch it again, watch another episode though. So unless I happen across it, I doubt I'll be contributing another review.
Okay.
Now, I know that I had another show on here, but I unfortunately did not get to it before we recorded. I know, this is the irony. We're on a very slow week, but I still didn't manage to get to everything. It's just the way it goes. But one thing I did get to do, and I didn't mention this earlier this episode because I knew I was going to come back to it now, is I finally got around to finishing the first season of Salem. Yay! And now I see what you mean. These three episodes were effectively kind of linked intrinsically together, so it makes sense for us to cover it this way. But why don't you go ahead and get us started here, Edmund, if you don't mind.
Certainly. First of the triumvirate was season 1, episode 11, Cat and Mouse. Fresh accusations are made against Alden while Anne learns the truth about her father.
Mm-hmm. What would you give this one if you can think back that
yes,
far?
Yes, yes. No, I luckily you did give me a little bit of warning, so I did get a chance to sort of collect my thoughts about these. But this was basically the trial episode, and I would give it a 7.5.
Okay. I would probably give it an 8. I understand where you're coming from, that it was a little bit less interesting and... But I can definitely get the feeling of things ramping up.
Having been watching it sort of more in sequence, this is the point. This is where I was getting to the point where yes, I understood that they were basically invoking the history of Salem, but I was getting a little bit tired of people accusing each other of being, you know, cause it's like the third or fourth episode in a row where that was what things were revolving around. So it was sort of accusation fatigue was setting in at this point.
You're a witch and you're a witch and you're a witch.
Yes.
Yes. Let's see, from here we've got season 1, episode 12, Ashes. Allegiances are broken and the fate of Salem is tested as Alden's trial begins. So technically that was kind of going on in the previous episode as well, but as the case may be, it was more the fallout of Alden's trial was being explored. What would you give this one?
I would give this one an 8.
Okay. And I would as well. Some good things definitely in this episode as we feel things really ramping up. And I love the fact that the episode ended with Mary pretty much having to reveal herself to Alden.
Yes. Yes.
Which I was not anticipating, but there we are.
Yeah. And also, I mean, this was sort of, I felt like after, not that he was taking the time, taking the time off as an actor, but just as a character, he'd sort of been run off to the side a little bit for the previous few episodes. This was Seth Gable getting to, return to the fray. And certainly the whole twist of Cotton coming in to defend Alden against his father, I thought made for a nice conflict.
Oh, yes. And let's see. Finally, we have Season 1, Episode 13, All Fall Down. Alden comes to learn Mary's biggest secret in the Season 1 finale. Again, these recaps are just like a few segments behind. Yeah, that's what they choose to focus on?
Well, I guess, I mean, yeah, sort of, you know, it was the end of the previous episode and then into the beginning of this episode.
All right, well, a lot happened here, but what would you give this one?
Yeah, I will give this an 8.5.
Okay, that's where I fell as well.
I mean, this was a crazy finale, and I like that.
Yes.
This is the show sort of, you know, I mean, it's been over the top all season, and this is when they kind of completely revealed, yes, we know what we're doing, and we're completely comfortable with going this far. Since I think it was, you know, and certainly it's not good to be a father on this show, because they pretty much all died.
Yes, and Anne coming into her own.
Yes.
Whew.
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy, power-hungry gingers. You gotta love it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A far cry from the very innocent young woman that was at the beginning of the season.
Yes.
Mary losing her control over the coven was definitely another big thing here, but then I don't even necessarily know what the heck happened at the end of this episode.
Yeah,
Everything went completely bonkers.
The thing that amused me once we got to the end of it was, you know, like was realizing, oh, they've just taken a page out of Once Upon a Time's book, except it's Red Smoke that can now just completely reset everything, and then they can just, you know, decide, just they have a complete open field to decide what they want to do next season. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this. What felt like it probably should have been, you know, was conceived as I don't know if it was conceived as being open-ended, but it felt like a one-season show that was given a second season. And I'm really hoping that this doesn't become one of those shows that really should have never gone beyond the season and should have just kept within those confines and not tried to go too far out of bounds, because it's been a superior, less, you know, buzz chasing show than American Horror Story has turned out to be.
Yes.
I don't want it to become American Horror Story, or, you know, early American Horror Story as the case may be, but it definitely is kind of giving me a little bit of pause, even as I kind of like the fact that they took everything and tossed it, you know, head over heels.
Yeah.
So we'll see, but
tossed it at the wall multiple times.
Yeah, no kidding. sorry, Xander Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a really strong season. It came in at basically right on an 8.0, which is amazing to me.
Oh yeah,
for the first show from a network, that's impressive.
Yeah.
And just for comparison's sake, as we kind of wrap this episode up, Manhattan is coming in almost identically right now with only a couple episodes to go. So consider the first two series produced by a basic cable network are both coming in at above average. That's impressive.
Yeah.
I wonder what their next project is going to be.
Absolutely. No. And WGN, I mean, it's a superstation that's aspiring to be a basic cable network. So.
Exactly. It's like what early TBS was. So.
Well, they've been a strong, you know, channel for a long time on cable lineups. I'm not sure where you are, but I've lived in several places where, yeah, they are a superstation. You know, they buy a lot of syndicated shows and they run them all throughout the course of the day, and they're on a lot of networks, you know, obviously to maximize, you know, advertising dollars, but no, they're on several cable channels already as a, standard channel, so it doesn't surprise me that, you know, that they now don't want to have to pay other people for content.
No, it's just their history of being this basically an independent station in Chicago that got themselves on all of these got this cable distribution, but still essentially being a local channel that you could just get anywhere in the country. Just about. I mean, I actually did see some figures where I think right now that they are on about 65% of cable networks nationwide. So, you know, yeah, not everywhere, but certainly, you know, a sizable reach.
Yeah, and I mean, this kind of material is only going to make that better.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm quite impressed. Let's see. Any last thoughts for this week, gentlemen, before we close out?
No, I think I need to rest up for the tsunami that awaits us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, I think, S.H.I.E.L.D. the most coming up over this next week.
Yeah, let me just go ahead and go down that list if you don't mind. Things that are going to be coming back this week. The Good Wife, Gotham starts, Sleepy Hollow comes back, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. comes back, Person of Interest comes back. Yeah, so that's just this coming week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
And The Blacklist for those of us who can't get enough James Spader.
Yeah, and I'm hoping I didn't miss anything here. But that looks like those are the big ones. Yeah. Monday night suddenly becomes extremely important.
Yes.
Fox, damn it. You did it again. Yeah. You dominated my Monday.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, watch, read, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.